wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
So we've got Dear Science right now, and Alan is in here with us in studio. So this week we're going to be starting off with Ebola. So Anika, you can take it away. What have we?
We're going to be starting off with Ebola. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So obviously it's just come out that the latest Ebola outbreak could have been sparked by a virus that lay dormant in someone for so long. Uh-huh. So could we maybe start by going through how a flare-up like this could have occurred?
Yeah, well, it's all very interesting, and this is just a very, very recent study, obviously, and a little bit of history, I guess, with Ebola. So it's been around since 1976, was first found in 1976, and it is it's a viral disease, just, you know, kind of like COVID is a viral disease. COVID is obviously getting all the headlines at the moment, and this sort of Ebola thing is you know, a bit on the back burner, and possibly shouldn't be, but we'll get to that. But Ebola is really, really nasty. So it's a hemorrhagic disease, so it causes bleeding. It causes both internal and external bleeding, and frighteningly, it kills 50% of the people that it infects. So in terms of, you know, COVID, I don't know what the numbers are for COVID, actually, but I think it's sort of down around 1-2,
yeah,
something like that.
Yeah, it's around 1-2%.
That's what I thought, yeah. So, you know, this is really, really nasty. Now, up until now, it's been confined to Africa, essentially, although there have been some cases. There was one notable one, I guess, in the UK. I think a nurse had returned from West Africa, and obviously it is contagious. Now, the good thing is that it's not contagious through air, so it's not transmitted through air like COVID can be, but you need to actually make contact with bodily fluids and stuff, so things like blood, semen, etc., those sorts of things. So there is an outbreak in the West African country of Guinea at the moment, and that started in late January. And what has been done with that is very, very similar to sort of the whole COVID thing as well. So we talk about tracing, and we talk about genetic analysis and stuff like that and everything. And so this has been done in this outbreak in Guinea as well. And this outbreak in Guinea is the first since 2013 to 2016. So they had a big outbreak then, so sort of 5 or so years ago. And that killed around about 11,000 people in Guinea. And that is relevant because they have been doing genetic testing of the Ebola virus from the current outbreak, and they've been comparing it with the virus from the previous outbreak from around about 2014, and they've found that the virus contains much, much, much fewer mutations than it would do had it been sort of, living or being passed on for all of those years, okay? And so what they have taken from this is that the virus, as you said, must have been lying dormant in somebody for all of that time. Now, one of the thoughts about how Ebola sort of got into the into humans was that it came from bats, and so they've figured out that that can't be the cause of this new infection now. So it's definitely not come from bats, just because it's so genetically similar to human samples from sort of 5, 6, 7 years ago now. And that's a bit scary when you think about it, because people can recover from Ebola, obviously. And when you recover, you think you're kind of out of the woods. But seemingly, you may still be infectious. And that's the enormous worry about all of this. So they had known prior to this study that over a period of about 1 year that it could be transmitted from people who have previously recovered from the virus. But now it seems that we're looking at sort of, you know, 5, 6, 7 years that this thing can lie dormant. And that is truly frightening.
Does it pose any threat to any other countries or the rest of Africa?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, all of these outbreaks that have happened, they seem to be very, very localized, thankfully. But then again, that's probably because, and I'm assuming here, that there's not too much sort of travel around Africa. I think people tend to sort of stay in the one place much, much more so than, you know, us folks who have to go around the world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this is very, very scary. Now, the good thing is that there is a vaccine for Ebola, which came out in around about 2019. And so thus far, around about 100,000 people in Guinea have been vaccinated since the vaccine came out, which sounds like a good number, except when you realize the population of Guinea is around about 12 million. So, you know, it's barely sort of a drop in the bucket with respect to that. So, you know, if this turns out to be the case and people are going to remain infectious for an awfully long time, then, you know, there's going to be an awful lot of stigma attached to those people.
Just quickly, could this speak to other viruses as well?
That's the thing. I mean, we have yet to know about COVID, presumably. You know, the feeling is that, you know, certainly you can't get COVID again once you've already had it. But who knows? We need more time, really, to figure out exactly what's going to go on here. But, you know, as I say, Ebola has really taken a back seat with COVID. But it is, you know, it is there. It's still there. It's in little pockets in Africa. And, you know, should it ever become... you know, widespread, should we ever have a pandemic of Ebola, that would dwarf, I imagine, the whole COVID thing. So just because, you know, it is so nasty. So
yeah. So moving on to our next topic.
Sorry to be a downer there, folks, but yeah.
The next one's slightly more lighthearted, and we're talking about fingerprints. Mm. So nerve endings in our fingers making us hypersensitive.
Indeed. So, you know, that's a question that I'd never really thought of, really, until I read this. And why do we have fingerprints? What's the point? And, you know, obviously, you know, nature didn't evolve for us to be uniquely identified by our fingerprints. That's, you know, that's just silly. So obviously it's not that. And so it had been hypothesized that fingerprints might have something to do with getting good grips on things. So helping your grip, which, you know, kind of makes sense when you think about it. And also might have something to do with your sense of touch. And so, you know, these were sort of a couple of explanations of why we have fingerprints. With the latter, sort of, people had done some experiments in the past and sort of showing that, yeah, these, you know, your finger, the actual ridges on your fingerprints are quite sensitive, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a bunch of workers in Sweden who sort of took up this question and said, right, well, just how sensitive are they? And can we sort of pin down exactly where on our fingertips we are the most sensitive, and do they have anything to do with the whole fingerprint side of things? So these workers in Sweden, what they did, they got 12 volunteers, which doesn't seem like a hell of a lot, but probably relatively difficult experiments to do, because they involve plunging a tungsten electrode in your arm to hit a nerve that connects to your hand. Yeah, I know.
Ouch.
I know. They're making
painful
ouch faces here, folks. But yeah. So I'm not sure that I'd volunteer for that particular one there. So basically, they were sitting with their hands immobilized in a dentist's chair, apparently, and with this electrode in their arm, in their upper arm, monitoring this particular nerve. And then their fingertips were stimulated by, they passed a card across their fingertips, and this card had little bumps on it that were about half a millimeter long, okay? So it's a little sort of rough thing. And they were sort of passing it over the fingertips in all possible directions, at all possible speeds, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And all the time they're monitoring this nerve in the upper arm, looking for any signs of stimulation of that nerve. And so what they found was that, yes, that they could sort of narrow down the sensitive parts of the fingertips to regions that were around about 0.4 of a millimeter wide, there or thereabouts. And 0.4 of a millimeter just happens to be about the width of a ridge on one of your fingerprints, okay? And so basically they're taking from this that, yes, it is these ridges, or that these ridges are the sensitive parts of your fingertips, and they are certainly responsive to mechanical stimuli. And, you know, we all know that, you know, we can feel because, you know, we can feel, we can touch and everything. But it seems now that the really important part of all of this touch, the really sensitive part is or are these ridges on your fingerprints, which is kind of cool. And so that's just been published in the Journal of Neuroscience. Okay. So,
yeah. I was going to say, like, I don't know about you guys at home, but I've just been touching my fingertips the whole time now. I've sort of been like, this is the...
I was reading the article and I was just staring at them, trying to, like, see my fingerprint. Ooh, what are you doing?
But, you know, totally unrelated, I guess, but it is astonishing that we all have completely non-identical fingerprints. I think that's, you know, that's quite amazing. And, you know, again... The question then becomes why? Why, you know, why are they all different? Why aren't they just the same?
Have but there been any scientific that's, yeah. reason to that?
I haven't looked would be the answer, but I'm damn sure there have been. You know, yeah. there have to have been. You know, that's evolution in action, I guess. So,
yeah.
So that's a kind of interesting story, and obviously more work is needed, as it always is with these things. So.
Yeah, so moving on to our last topic for today, we're looking at cannabis farms and how much carbon emissions they produce. So,
slightly
yes,
worrying.
Indeed, yes. Very, very interesting story, this one. So this is a study, again, just recently published in the journal Nature Sustainability. So that's one of the Nature groups of papers, which is the very, very highest echelon of scientific journals. So we go to the US state of Colorado, and they legalized marijuana in 2012. And the first shops that were tasked with selling marijuana came or were opened in 2014. So they've been going for a while now. And so a bunch of workers at Colorado State University were interested in just what the carbon footprint of cannabis farms were or are, I guess. And not only did they just look at their home state of Colorado, but they also looked at a whole lot of other states around the US as well. And this was really interesting because what they found was that the greenhouse gas emissions from the marijuana farms in Colorado were greater than those from coal mining in Colorado. And Colorado is the 10th biggest coal mining state in the USA, and that's about 21.8 million tons every year of
that's
coal.
That's insane.
It is when you think about it. I think that's extraordinary. And so not only Colorado, they looked at all of the states in the U.S., well, many of the states in the U.S., and they were trying to figure out basically how much energy does it take what's the equivalent energy required to grow 1 ounce, or sorry, 28 grams, as we call it in, you know, we're metric folks. So 28 grams of marijuana, and that is equivalent to, depending on where you live in the States, anywhere between 25 to 60 litres of petrol. So burning that, so that's your carbon emissions, essentially. So but that's, you know, between a half and a full tank of gas probably for your average car, there or thereabouts.
And this is just for indoor cannabis.
Now, that's the point. That's the big thing, is that you're talking that most of the cannabis in the States is grown indoors. So that's where the big energy consumption is coming from. So you're needing these very, very high-powered lights. You're needing these climate control systems. These are all operated, obviously, by non-renewable electricity in the States at the moment anyway. So obviously, if they went to greenhouses and stuff like that, then these emissions would drop enormously. But seemingly there's no real incentive to do that at the moment, because the profit margin on growing this stuff is just so huge, they just don't give a toss, really. Seemingly, that's, you know, that seems to be the situation. And probably, I don't know, growing indoors is much easier. You haven't got the vagaries of the weather and stuff like that, you know. Certainly Colorado can get really hot and really cold, so it's probably just easier to do it indoors. So there's an obvious lesson, I think, to take from this particular study, that maybe people will or should or whatever. And obviously the more renewable energy that you can use in this, the better for everybody with absolutely everything, you know, not just only growing marijuana or anything like that. You know, we need to invest more in solar, wind, all of that sort of stuff, and the world will be a better place for it. So yeah.
So me and Anika were also just wondering, like, how do you measure gases? How do you measure the weight of gas?
How do you just weigh it?
But like, how?
Gas
has a weight. Okay, you take an empty balloon.
Yeah.
And then you blow it up, and you weigh
it. And it will weigh
the empty. Yeah. Because you've got air in there.
But what about when it comes to, like, that's a huge amount of, like, carbon dioxide? Like, how do they, does it get condensed?
So in that case, they would calculate. So you've got, let's say you've got 60 litres of petrol, okay? First year chemistry here, folks. So we assume that all of the carbon in that petrol gets converted to carbon dioxide. So if you know how much petrol you start off with, you can figure out what the weight of CO2 that would be evolved from that if it all turned into CO2. So stoichiometry.
Okay.
Stoichiometry. I can see perhaps neither of you have done first year chem, maybe?
I did during high school, but I think I forgot lots of it.
Come to my lectures, I'll tell you all. There you go.
Sweet. Well, thank you so much for that, Alan. And that was Dear Science.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Sweet.